But now it's time to join Olympic athlete Jonathan Edwards for the final programme in his series looking at how science shapes and explains our world. This week, Jonathan takes a leap into science fiction.
I think I can say quite categorically that my favourite film of all time is The Matrix. It describes a future world controlled by an artificial intelligence, where humans are born into pods and are tapped for their electromagnetic energy. It's a film of breathtaking special effects, but a film also that raises all sorts of issues about the relationship between humans and machines. At its worst, artificial intelligence, AI as it's usually called, seems to threaten our very concepts of free will and self-determination. AI plays on our fears and suspicions of computers taking over our world. So, should we be frightened? I went to Edinburgh University, to one of the world's leading AI research centres, to find out more. In a cramped office in the Department of Informatics, Professor Chris Williams, director of the Institute for Adaptive and Neural Computation, is trying to teach a computer to harmonise in the style of J.S. Bach.
We've taken a corpus of chorales. What we've tried to do is to extract, I wouldn't exactly say rules, but the kinds of structure of harmonisation that Bach used. That means that we can both provide novel harmonizations for the chorales that he already did, and we can also then harmonize new tunes in the style of Bach, well, at least hopefully roughly in the style of Bach.
Now, could that be varied? Because I guess there are lots of...
Excellent question, and the answer is yes. We can actually produce, as it were, the most likely harmony under our system, but we can also produce alternative, less likely harmonizations. So actually we have an example here of a worse harmonisation, or less one, less probable.
Play worse.
Yes. Certainly what this system will output is a sort of probability for this harmonisation.
Bit duff.
Yes. The worst one is less probable than the first one I played to you, which is sort of its optimal harmonisation. This system will know something about the transitions between different chords, and so it can tell when something was quite improbable.
Chris, it seems to me that if AI is to advance, the whole idea of machines learning is at the nub of the issue. Because if it's just a case of, you know, us overseeing a computer, putting in information at every single point, then, you know, it's not much more than a desktop, really, is it?
Well, I certainly agree that machine learning will be an absolutely crucial part of developing artificial intelligences. So basically there are two or three different kinds of machine learning. One is called supervised learning, where you specify the task and you penalize it when it makes the wrong answer, like when the teacher sort of marks your sums with a tick or a cross or something like this. I guess I wanted to come on to the other kinds of learning. Those would be unsupervised learning and also reinforcement learning. Reinforcement learning is perhaps a nice example when we're trying to achieve a goal. Maybe we're trying to plan a trip to the airport. Then there's a large number of steps that we have to undertake, and these intermediate sequences of events are not explicitly penalized. We're only interested in specifying, as it were, the goal. That's reinforcement learning, so we can sort of back off from saying precisely what the system should do at every stage and only give it this more generalized goal. At the other extreme, there's something called unsupervised learning, where basically the system is provided with some data. One example would be something like a vision camera, and it's receiving this video data. For example, we sort of imagine things happening outside in the world and the computer is observing those. What we'd like to do is for the computer to understand, in quotes, what's the structure of the world, for example. Are there people moving around? Are there cars? Are there trees swaying in the wind? All these things. One way to try and achieve that, rather than through direct supervision, is just to try to set up systems that learn about the structure of the world. So we might call that unsupervised learning, and that's another kind of learning.
I mean, interesting, you talk about understand, and you know, you give the inverted commas yes. sign as if they don't really understand. But that comes back to this point about how we learn and what our understanding is, because we might look at the data coming in from a CCTV camera, and we've learned, haven't we, through a process to say, he or she looks suspicious, this or that shouldn't be happening. So is it just a question of just the complexity of processing this information, which humans manage to do incredibly well in some aspects? It is much more difficult for computers to do, and vice versa. I mean, we can't remember huge amounts of data. So it's just kind of different systems.
Well, I think the challenge for artificial intelligence is really that, as you say, it's quite easy to make computers do certain kinds of tasks and maybe tasks that humans are not very good at. If we want to understand how humans work, and I think that's one of the goals of science, then one way we can try and do that is to build systems that do the kinds of tasks that humans do. It's not bringing humans down to the level of machines, but more trying to raise machines to the level of humans.
Hi, I'm Heather, and I'd like to say hello to Jonathan Edwards and the BBC. I hope you can record everything you need for your show.
If, as Chris says, one of the goals of AI is to develop machines that do what we do, then clearly machines need to talk. We like talking, we're very good at it, and we've developed highly sophisticated ways of doing it. Speech comes naturally to us. We do it without thinking. And I'm beginning to realise that it's those things that we find easy that are often the hardest to replicate in a machine. Across the square from Chris Williams, in a slightly more spacious office, Steve Reynolds and Matthew Aylett are working on voice synthesis.
The real key to speech is variation. We never say the same thing in the same way twice. Even the same person varies everything. There's no question that doing a direct rendition of what you say is easy. You just record it, send it, bang, it's exactly the same. But if we want to change it a bit, so if we want to make you seem a bit more sort of excited about something, or if we want to change the words you want to use, then that is hard.
And it's also hard so we can give a computer system the text of what you want to say, and it will produce intelligible synthetic speech, but you do it again, it will be the same. You do it in a different context, it will be the same. And this variation is actually the key to communication. The way you say precisely the same text in one context, if you're in a pub with your friends, can be very, very different to the way you say it if you're on the telephone and it's a very bad line. Then you just want to be intelligible, whereas in the pub, you're much more relaxed and spontaneous.
How do we learn those things? And in trying to get a computer to learn those things, are we modelling what we're doing as humans, or is just are we doing it in a completely different way?
Well, for synthesis at the moment, it's actually changing. So one thing that might be interesting, if I play synthesis from the 80s, you'll be able to hear, you know, why, when I say it's difficult, why is it difficult? Well, this is groundbreaking synthesis from the 80s. You might recognise it to some extent.
I am perfect Paul, the standard male voice.
I am beautiful Betty, the standard female voice. Some people think I sound a bit like a man.
I am huge Harry, a very large person with a deep voice. I can serve as an authority figure.
My name is Kit the Kid, and I am about 10 years old. Do I sound like a boy or a girl?
Now, one of the things I think is very interesting in that cut is the first thing they were interested in was trying to get over characterization with the voice. And of course, it all really sounds like the same person speaking a bit different, which it more or less is, right? Now, if you go forward another 10 years, what we then started doing was trying to generate synthesis using bits of real speech. And this is the Festival Diphone system.
This is a short introduction to the Festival Speech Synthesis System. Festival was developed by Alan Black and Paul Taylor at the Centre for Speech Technology Research, University of Edinburgh.
Now, that flows more, it has more intonation, but again, it's not fooling anyone, right? So now what we do is we really do a cheat. What we do is record a lot of someone and then cut it all up and stick it back together again in the right order, which is harder than it sounds, actually. But
you're always trying to convince me it's all harder than it sounds at the moment.
I mean, definitely, first and foremost, I'm probably an engineer more than anything else, which means that I pick and choose whatever I can use to put together to get my system to sound good, right? And you can do pretty well. If I play some of the emotional stuff, you can change the voice to make it sound emotional. So this is her sounding a little bit irritated.
You never listen to anything I say.
This is her sounding a bit more cheerful.
What a lovely day.
This is her sounding a bit more serene.
I feel relaxed.
That's almost sexy, actually.
Oh, that's pretty good, that one.
And, that's very good,
this voice. Sorry, well, we are engineers, you know.
Our ability to convey ideas, emotions and desires through speech is one of the things that marks us out from other living creatures. We are social animals, and our ability to communicate strengthens social bonds. We don't tend to think of AI as a social concept, but if it is to mimic human intelligence, then it clearly needs this social dimension. So how do you go about developing systems to make AI sociable?
I'm Dave Robertson, and I'm a lecturer in the Centre for Intelligent Systems and their Applications in Informatics.
Dave's trying to introduce social interaction into AI. He's working with a computer game where two teams, three red players and three blue players, are programmed to fight and destroy each other. Individually, the blue team are much better fighters than the red team, but just a little bit of social cooperation transforms the red team's chances of survival.
What we do is we take the standard computer game and then we overlay it with a little bit of coordination. And this is how we describe the coordination. It looks like a bit of mass. It is actually a bit of mass. And the particular interaction here is just a little bit of communication about, I'm doing this over here now, why don't you consider coming along and helping me? So they're being helpful. Let me just show you very quickly what happens if you don't do that. Okay.
We've deactivated that particular
programming. That, and these red guys are just dying on their feet, basically. They were drawing even before here. Now they're not even coming close.
It's an annihilation.
Yeah. And the reason why is because they're not behaving socially. And the interesting thing is the amount of social glue you need to get these guys to behave intelligently in a social sense is very little. It's just that little thing I show you there.
So that's all it is, actually. I mean, it's like three... Yeah,
all of that plus a lot of clever stuff getting it to interact with the game and so on. But the way people are building a lot of intelligent systems now is out of those kinds of components.
I mean, it sounds like a very much different take on AI rather than this ultimate goal of a kind of Matrix-type humans versus computers or Terminator, whatever it would be.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, those sort of films are good entertainment, you know, hugely enjoyable, and it's interesting to kind of use them in almost a sort of philosophical sense to think about how life might be were it slightly different. I think maybe they tell you more about humanity in some sense than they do about computing. But when it comes down to building computer systems, it's a lot more like the kind of Roger Rabbit kind of thing. So in Roger Rabbit, which you are probably not familiar with, I enjoyed Roger Rabbit. I just can't take the violence in The Matrix. But in Roger Rabbit, it's kind of interesting because what happens is there are a bunch of cartoons, and you know they're cartoons, actually because the technology at that time pretty much insisted that's all you could have. And you know there are people, but they interact very, very meaningfully. And the nice, interesting thing in Roger Rabbit is in the end, Bob Hoskins, who's the kind of main protagonist, ends up having to actually become kind of involved very intimately in the kind of cartoon world in order to solve the problem he has to solve, to find out who killed whoever it was, I forget, actually. And that's kind of the way we've gone as well. I mean, when we interact with a system like this, you know, you and I are sitting looking at a system like this, and I mean, it's just pixels on a screen, but it's very compelling for us because it looks kind of real. And because it looks real and because we enjoy using it, then what happens is we adapt to it. So that happens with a computer game. That also happens with shopping on the web. That's not AI, but it is society adapting to a computer program. And as society adapts to a computer program, what that does is lower the hurdle for people who want to build smart systems that interact with humans, because humans have come part of the way. And that's what happened with Roger Rabbit. Bob Hoskins came part of the way to Roger Rabbit's world.
The convergence of human and technological worlds is all around us. Computers and mobile phones are now so embedded in our lives, it's almost impossible to imagine life without them. As Dave said, the more reliant we become on technology, the more we adapt to it. And if, by and large, we're comfortable with machines that make our lives easier, it's not that big a step to co-opt intelligent systems to give us a hand. Austin Tate works at the AI Applications Institute at Edinburgh University. He's developing an intelligent system to help us deal more efficiently with emergencies.
Austin, we're surrounded here by what looks like computer screens up on the wall. Can you tell me exactly what we're looking at?
Yeah, we're in an emergency response centre. This is an experimental version of such a centre. You would typically see these in fire brigades or in police stations or in response centres in emergency zones where you might get earthquakes and so on. And we're trying to gather information during a messy situation. And what's happening here is that this would be collecting that information and trying to assist the emergency coordinators to take a response. So what's going on with the AI behind this is that we've got intelligent agents which are running. So the IX agents, as we call them, just intelligent agents, sit behind the scenes, and they're trying to make sense of the plans and share them with the humans. That's what we're trying to do.
I understand that. Just to pick up on something that you talked about earlier, sort of differentiating between an intelligent system and a non-intelligent system, what would you exactly mean by that?
Now, what's intelligent? Statistical analysis of data is typically a mathematical technique, often not considered intelligent. Search came from AI, but also from operational research, and aspects of it can be intelligent. But in some cases, we're using search techniques here, which you would consider themselves not to be intelligent. It's the way we put it all together. We would consider it to be an intelligent agent because of its properties, what it does, as opposed to the individual techniques inside it.
Seeming to choose one option over another, would that be sort of...
Yes, say choosing one option over another with knowledge of why one response would be better, let's say in terms of injury to people or speed of response. That would be linking two things. It would be linking the search methods to find the options, linking that to an evaluation which had some knowledge of what good outcomes were. Then you're into the area which is more like intelligent systems.
It's more like intelligent systems. Yes. Well...
There is a gradient.
There's gradient. I think that's the point, isn't it?
So as an engineer doing AI applications, we come across this all the time. We were having a discussion where people were talking about the different levels of intelligence. And a lot of that is about things which at one time in the subject seem intelligent, but when they're done, are considered to be fairly straightforward and perhaps mathematical in nature. An example being chess playing, which at one time was the holy grail of many people in AI, and is now considered to be something which can be done with brute force computing technology.
It's interesting, isn't it? So what we might call human intelligence is just something we don't really understand.
I'd consider it an intelligent system if it performed like a clever human that you were observing.
Even though there's nothing particularly intelligent to what this computer's doing here than, to say, a simple Google search, which you might think was quite basic.
Not necessarily basic. Again, it depends how it's integrating all the different parts. But if it's making available the knowledge, if it's looking at the meaning of the data and it's trying to assimilate all of that together and present it in a form that's useful for taking decisions, I call it an intelligent system.
Humans and AI working together. And you can understand on that basis why Austin defines intelligence in terms of outcome, even if, as he admits, not all the elements in his program are in fact intelligent themselves. His comments that a chess-playing AI might not be as intelligent as we'd once thought reminds us of just how slippery the word can be. Andy Clark is Professor of Philosophy at Edinburgh. AI raises all sorts of philosophical issues for him to muse on. For instance, is artificial intelligence intelligent at all?
What we've seen in AI a lot, I think, is taking little slices of human intelligence, like the ability to play chess, and coming up with brute force ways of making great progress with problems like that, but maybe not quite as much progress as we'd like in the more general form of intelligence, a kind that can flexibly apply itself to a brand new problem domain. You know, you meet a new situation in the street one day, and you have a way of going on. And it's very, very hard to build that sort of common sense intelligence into a machine. To me, that's the sort of hardest problem for artificial intelligence, is getting some common sense into them.
The whole AI project, philosophically, what do you think drives it? I mean, it's, you know, there's some very practical systems, isn't there? We've looked at emergency response, for example. Mm-hmm. Is that what's driving it, do you think?
No, I think it's really driven by the basic desire to understand what we are and how we work. We're just trying to understand ourselves by seeing how hard it is to build anything that is even a little bit like us.
I mean, that is very much, I think, what I've discovered being here today, is that there are some clearly very clever systems that have been developed, but they don't really scratch the surface of what a human can do.
Yeah, one of the issues that's coming up in the sort of philosophical literature is the relations between what you could think of as life and mind. So the artificial systems that we build are kind of modelled on our idea of mind, but we've left out a lot of the stuff that is to do with life, you know, the basic ability of a system to repair itself, basic abilities actually of perception and motion, some of them, although people are addressing those issues a lot more now. But I think there are issues about just the nature of living systems, and maybe at first we thought, well, that's not so important for mind. Mind is something much more abstract and high level. And maybe it's not so easy to build the abstract high level stuff you want unless you get all the lower levels right.
So do you think that trying to model human intelligence in its broadest sense is maybe going about it in slightly the wrong way? Does it need to look at a different avenue in order to develop, to make the next step, to make it look more human?
Of course, there's an issue there about whether we want it to look more human. You know, it might be that the most successful artificial intelligences we come up with are really non-human in the way that they think, but nonetheless, they do think, just like other animals that are non-human animals, I think, really do think. They just don't think in quite the same ways as we do.
I mean, you talk about thinking, and that maybe gets to the nub of it, because I don't believe in any way that computers think. There's a set of rules, of protocols, of algorithms, and they follow them through, but they depend on human thinking and human logic, if you like. And there's always a sense that there's, I don't know, maybe it's this idea of a soul, something spiritual, mm-hmm. and maybe not. I mean, that for me is almost at the heart of this AI thing, that if you can discover how we have this level of consciousness, and there's something in me which does thinking, free will obviously coming into that, I have choice rather than just being cause and effect. That almost seems to be the nub of it for me.
I think you're right that we have this intuition that that's got to be missing in an artificial system, but I do think we're wrong to have that intuition. I guess I'm a kind of materialist about this. I think that in the end we're just going to have to face up to the fact that we're just a bunch of unintelligent stuff, nicely orchestrated, that turns out to be able to do really cool things in the world. You just have to believe in really fancy machinery.
Player one, column four. Player two, column four. Move confirmed.
When Andy talked about fancy machinery, he meant us. After I left his office, I went to the Institute of Perception, Action and Behaviour for my last appointment of a busy day, and an encounter with another piece of fancy machinery.
Player 2, column 5. Move confirmed.
Setu Vijayakumar and Bob Fisher have developed a robot that plays Connect 4. It has a camera for an eye, and when it sees your move, it makes an intelligent decision about where to place its counter. A robot arm then picks up a counter from a feeder and drops it into position on the playing board. When the robot's made its move, it tells you what it's done. So, this is only a game, but there is a serious point behind it. Setu and Bob's robot does many of the things that we do. It sees, it talks, it makes intelligent decisions, it moves. And as I played, Setu and Bob told me a little bit more about their creation.
I would actually call this robot the first step in our whole quest of putting AI into robotics. But what is still very unsatisfying about this Connect 4 playing robot, although impressive it may be, is that it's very difficult to get it to respond to things which are not planned for. Its moves are programmed. While it's moving, if I suddenly try and hold its arm, it would be pretty catastrophic. Whereas humans and animals have a very interesting property, which is being soft and compliant. So this balance of accuracy and compliance is still, we're very far away in getting that in robotics.
Player two, column four.
Right, okay. So the robot has now placed its yellow disc next to mine, and I'm going to place mine next to his or its. Does it have a name?
Not really.
No?
No.
I'm disappointed.
If I can make a comment here while we're playing, is that many people think that the reasoning portion of artificial intelligence is the hard bit, but the process of building this helps to show up actually the physical bit of artificial intelligence is actually probably the harder bit and where we've made the least progress. This Connect 4 playing robot is a very carefully engineered robot with a precise placement of the playing field, the feeder with all the discs in it, the robot, the camera, everything has been very carefully engineered so it works right more or less every time. And that's just symptomatic of robotics and vision. It just takes a lot of hard work to get the simplest things to work right.
Yes, I think one of the comments that people have made is that in a chess-playing robot, the toughest bit is actually for the robot to go reach for the actual piece and make the move, not about all this very difficult computation that goes behind it, but the actual sort of sensory motor, physical embodiment of the sensory motor, so to say.
It's one of the things I found through the course of this day, that actually the clever bits of AI are the bits that you don't expect. It's sort of almost counterintuitive, and all this kind of number-crunching stuff, you know, that's almost easy, isn't it? The difficult bit is trying to win.
Player two, column five.
Well, just to update you, I've got three in a row. Unfortunately, that's not the game of the game. How do you think I'm doing?
Player one, column five.
So fine so far.
Not lost so far, that's a good sign. Yes.
I want to comment here that the robot actually failed in putting the disk in. It actually got stuck a little bit, and the robot put it in the wrong place, and it didn't fall into the slot. So
it just failed.
But the robot didn't detect that itself.
Yes.
And it has no way of recovering from that. We had to fix it ourselves.
Yes, yeah.
Right. I feel I'm going to lose. I don't know why.
Actually, I think you're doing pretty well. It's sort of keeping in a bit of a mess here. So
you're saying there's no method to my play?
No. It's
Player 2, column 4, move confirmed. Player 1, column 2.
Yes.
Player 2 wins.
Well done.
Humans triumph.
Yes.
It was nothing.
Yes.
You put it on easy, didn't you?
No, it's actually, you did very well.
Completely fluky.
Yeah. What's he doing here?
It's doing sort of sad dance.
Yeah. Is it a sad? Have you programmed a sad dance in?
Well,
it may have been his victory dance as well.
I think that's really impressive. There's lots of different things going on here, isn't there?
Yes.
You've got a vision element, you've got a movement element, you've got a computational element all coming in together.
Yes.
Where some of the other stuff I've seen is very clever, but it works on a basic
individual
bits and basically computers doing clever searches.
Mm. Right.
But I think the game playing here is largely just a big search problem.
Yes.
The computer is looking at what moves could you make in response to that, what alternative moves could it make, additional moves could it make, and so on. And then maybe this is a very large space of possible moves and counter moves, but the computer is very fast and it quickly explores down to a certain level of depth about that. But at the core of all of this is a kind of search process, which is very distinctively artificial intelligence. And when it comes to humans, maybe chess playing or something, but I don't think humans do this kind of search process in this kind of way. So it's a very different kind of reasoning.
Impressive as Bob and Setu's little robot is, it's still a long way from our starting point, the Matrix, and its vision of an artificial intelligence powerful enough to control the world. The robot makes me realise what extraordinary constructs we humans are. Whether or not you accept Andy Clark's line of reasoning that humans are nothing more or less than biological machines, I'm still in awe of what we can do. AI research, if nothing else, has the effect of throwing our abilities into even sharper relief.
Jonathan Edwards Looks Into was produced by John Watkins.